Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. Today we're talking to Penny Lee, who's a linguist who for many years was a lecturer at the University of Western Australia in educational linguistics. One of her major scholarly contributions, which would be of particular interest to the listeners of this podcast, is her 1996 study of the work of Benjamin Lee Whorf, The Whorf Theory Complex, A Critical Reconstruction. So continuing our current series of oral history interviews in contemporary linguistics, we're going to talk to Penny about her life and work. So Penny, to get us started, maybe you could tell us how you got into linguistics.
Well, actually, through Whorf. So that might seem quite weird, but apparently it's not so weird for people of my generation. I had been working in Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory of Australia in 1982-83. And when I came back to Perth, I had a number of small jobs. I came back to Perth for family reasons. And I was working at a College of Advanced Education, which is now Edith Cowan University, kind of looking after what in those days was called an Aboriginal enclave. It was a study centre, a pioneering one, actually, in Australian universities, a support centre and that sort of thing for Indigenous students. And one day I went to a colleague, Toby Metcalf, and we were chatting away. He was interested because his research was on Bardi in Northern WA. And I said to him, it was obvious that I was missing the Yolngu people in the North. I said, but Toby, they think differently. Aha, he said, you'd better read Whorf. I said, who's Whorf? He said, go to the library, get a book called Language, Thought and Reality and see what you think. So the next thing is I devoured that very quickly. That's the collection of Benjamin Lee Whorf's collected writings. Put together in 1956 by a guy called John Carroll, John B. Carroll, who later became quite well known in Whorf-related studies. And I said, well, how do I get to study linguistics? Because my background had been in education. I had an arts degree and a dip ed, as they called it at the time. My training was in the 1960s, early to mid-60s, and in Western Australia. I certainly knew of anthropology by the 80s, and I certainly knew of linguistics by the 80s. But in the 60s, I probably didn't know that linguistics existed as a discipline. It wasn't offered at UWA, the University of Western Australia, where I studied. It was the only university at that time in the state. Anyway, he said, well, you could do our graduate diploma in language studies. And they had a stream which was language teaching. So I launched into that and got that done in a couple of years. And I was teaching something called multicultural ed. Then I lost that job. They said, you don't have a master's degree. So I went to UWA and said, I need a master's degree, and started doing a master in sort of educational linguistics. I know I remember I had to do some research methods and that sort of thing. But my interest, I was very quickly moved to a thesis only program, where I was going to study Whorf. Subsequently, I discovered that through a kind correspondent that Whorf's collected papers existed. They were held in the Yale University archives and manuscripts, and you could get 5 reels of microfilm, which I then proceeded to get. I still didn't know that a guy called John Lucy existed, and he was making his name from the University of Chicago in Whorf studies, and maintained that reputation in a much more competitive way than I ever could, being based, you know, in one of the smaller states of Western Australia in terms of population, and a long, long way from international conferences and so on, where he was really at the centre of anthropological linguistics studies, or one of the centres. Anyway, that was cool. I started getting the microfilm. I started reading it and studying it intensively. I studied Hopi for 3 months. I read all of the 800 letters that Whorf had written or received. I read his notes as far as I could. You know, I wasn't so interested in Hebrew, which was hundreds of pages of notes. There were lots of things that Worf had been interested in before he ever became associated with this, what's called the Yale Circle around Edward Sapir. But anyway, I was well on the way to that, and it looked like it was too big for a master's, so I had to go before a panel, and it was upgraded to a PhD. So you can see that, you know, I have said in the past sometimes to people, well, people might have said, where did you learn, you know, where did you study linguistics? Well, basically, I studied linguistics from Worf, because his language, thought and reality was the core, and everything else was in the pursuit of trying to understand what he was interested in. Now, part of that did come from the fact that in Arnhem Land, I had been doing linguistic work, essentially anthropological sort of. I didn't have qualifications, but I have it appears that I've got a good ear, a good phonological ear. And I was working with very congenial local people, native speakers of the Yolngu languages. So we were working for an outfit called Aboriginal Sacred Sites Authority of the Northern Territory. And my job, I was contracted to document three large site complexes in northeast Arnhem Land around the town of Yirrkala. And that involved visiting all the right people, taking tapes, transcribing them, and translating them. So that's not a thing that an amateur could have done. My Yolngu counterpart and a few others, but the core one, they were all very skilled and intuitively bilingual people. The Yolngu people had long contact with other cultures, primarily the Macassans or Indonesians who used to come down in the monsoon. And there are many Macassan words in their languages. The interest in Worf and the idea that people think differently is really because I was rapidly becoming not highly proficient bilingual, but in a sociolinguistic sense, very much immersed in the culture. And it evoked childhood memories. I had been a bilingual child, again, in a very different language, in Fiji. There was something very deep in knowing another language, perhaps particularly as a child. And so that plus my few years as a bit of a so-called hippie dropout on the South Coast, you know, reading the sorts of things that Worf read. So Worf was reading stuff in the 30s that I was reading in the 70s. So there's a theosophical bookshop in Perth. I'd been there. I'd bought the books. I knew exactly what he was talking about. So when I read his stuff, it just immediately made sense. I didn't have any trouble with modern physics, not because I understand physics. I don't have any mathematics, really, and I probably would have been absolutely useless. I couldn't have done Chomsky in linguistics because I don't have that type of mind. And I probably would have had difficulty with descriptive linguistics because I wouldn't have wanted to be bothered with the intricacies of that side of language study, you know, the technical side, because I acquired languages by osmosis. That's how you do as a child, and that's how I was doing it in Arnhem Land. But, you know, I had read books by David Bohm and Fritjof Capra, and I knew all about modern physics, or at least as much as your average New Age person did in the 70s. So unlike a lot of people who read Worf, even that part was immediately comprehensible to me. I knew what he was talking about. I knew why it was exciting. I understood how it related to Buddhist and Hindu thought from his theosophical side. And you might be interested to know that he almost never told any linguist colleagues about his interest in theosophy. This is really quite intriguing, and it comes out in documents which are now available, his diaries. So he kept obsessive diaries. He says once in one of his diary entries that he told Carl Vogelin something about theosophy, and he said he is the first linguist that I've ever mentioned that side of my life to. But he's extremely careful, and he may have been very careful even with Sapir, and he was very open with Sapir, and it appears that Sapir seems to be very pally with him or chatty. You know, he ate there, he slept overnight on one occasion.
So you mentioned that John Lucy was working on Worf around the same time that you got interested in him. But was John Lucy's approach the same as yours or comparable to yours? Because I guess John Lucy was probably trying to develop a sort of neo-Worfianism, wasn't he? Like he was trying to build his own hypotheses on the basis of Worfian
yes
material.
And no. Yeah. I mean, it was his PhD thesis too. He got two books out of it. Clever. I only got one. But he could do that because his first book attempts to develop a theory of what Worf meant by linguistic relativity. His overview of the research done by linguists and anthropologists in the 40s, 50s, and 60s is excellent. You know, he does a fantastic literature review, basically. It would have been the lit review chapter of his thesis. So that's an excellent summary of everything pretty well up to him. And certainly, and his second book is his own research with Yucatan Maya. It's good, it's decent. And his wife has also worked in that area. But, well, he didn't have access to the unpublished materials. He didn't appear to know that they existed at Yale, which is fair enough. I mean, I just almost accidentally, a correspondent said, by the way, did y'all know that there was such a thing as Benjamin Lee Worf papers? So he didn't have access to that. And he came up with the idea that linguistic relativity was all about analogical transfer from, and so you can read his books to see how he shows that and demonstrates it with diagrams and so on. I mean, analogical transfer or the occurrence of analogy in linguistic data was reasonably commonplace idea in the 30s, so it wasn't off target in a sense. But the interesting thing from my perspective is that I immediately saw that somehow, whether it was his supervisors or whether it was something else, goodness knows, but he'd missed the fact that Worf gave two explicit definitions of what he meant by a principle of linguistic relativity. Well, if a scholar does that, you know, this is what I mean by linguistic relativity, then you'd better follow it. You'd better try and work out what he was talking about. But it is interesting that even Silverstein misunderstood one of the physics references. So if you weren't an ex-hippie, you didn't know what he was talking about when he was talking about physics, right? You know, there's a comment, I've published a sentence on it, just saying, but that's not what indeterminacy is in physics. You know, that's not what Worf was talking about. The principle of linguistic relativity is purely and simply and quite explicitly based on Einstein's principle of relativity, which is about different observers in different situations see the same thing differently, to put it bluntly, right? And in a theory or a principle, so he never thought it was of it as a hypothesis. The term hypothesis did not come in until after Sapir and Worf were both dead. No one said it was a hypothesis until the 50s, late 40s, perhaps at the very, very earliest. And they'd both gone by then. So basically, it's the same thing as physical relativity, except that the vehicle for the difference in the way your interpretation occurs or your attention to phenomena is mediated by language. That's all. That's all it is. So, you know, if you operate out of more than one language, almost all bilinguals will tell you, yeah, you do feel differently, or you think differently about such and such. That's all it is. Except that when you start looking, like a lot of good scholars have, at the detail of what is specifically isolated out of general sensory perception, you'll find that one language, take a lexeme. A lexeme will specifically name something in one language, but not in another, or differently in another. It's just a commonplace that absolutely faithful translation is extremely difficult, except in maybe very closely related languages. So what he's saying is, no, the world isn't different, and no, the human being isn't different, and no, the brain isn't inherently different, innately different. What is different is simply that your attention is either optionally or compulsorily directed to different aspects of experience. And Worf made it very clear that the most significant area in which linguistic relativity operates is through the grammar. Why? Because the grammar is compulsory in the language. You can always learn another name for something. You can even use the name from another language. But you don't transfer the grammar of another language into your language in order to make you start noticing a phenomenon that is highlighted by the grammar, in his case, let's say Hopi, and not highlighted at all, completely ignored, or dealt with totally differently in another language. That's basically, it's about training your perception. It's about training your attention. And a guy called Dan Slobin used the term thinking for speaking. You know, acquiring a language helps you to learn to think in a particular way so that you can speak appropriately in communities of speakers of that language. I think that thinking for speaking is a terrific insight, except that these forces operate whether you are speaking or not. Speech and thought are not absolutely differentiated, are they? They can't be. And linguistic relativity can operate at any level of coherence of language. If there's any kind of language or linguistic thinking, as Worf called it, impinging on your thought processes, it could be operating.
So you also edited a second edition of Language, Thought and Reality.
Yeah,
in 2012.
I had actually been very frustrated, practically memorizing the appearance of pages in, I call it LTR, Language, Thought and Reality, over many years by then. So I knew exactly where on the page certain statements were, but it still was frustrating not to know which page. And of course, you couldn't search. There was no electronic version of the book. And so I'd written to MIT Press and said, this book of yours, which is, I don't know if you know, it's actually MIT Press's all-time bestseller, or if it's not quite the bestseller, it's the bestseller in competition with Vygotsky. There's something about the title Language and Thought that really appeals to all kinds of buyers. They've put out various editions. Anyway, I said, look, an index would be fantastic. You could put out a second edition that was into goodness knows how many printings, reprintings. And they said, fair enough. They paid me $400 American, and I made an index, not a professional index, but an index that had all the terms in it that I wanted. And, you know, like points in the pattern and linguistic thinking. And I did that, and that kind of sat there for a while. But I made the mistake at a conference of excitedly telling everyone that future copies of Language, Thought and Reality would have an index. I then heard that a second edition was going ahead, and my friend John Lucy had offered to write an afterword for it. So I wrote back to the editor and I said, but don't you know that John Carroll is still alive? He should at least be consulted. Because I had never envisaged a second edition. I just wanted an index. Anyway, they promptly contacted Carroll and sent him drafts of what John was doing. And Carroll copied me in on critiques. Anyway, John had some kind of a bicycle accident, and for some reason that edition never happened. And then years later, so that's the late 90s, and then in 2010 or 11 or something, I heard a second edition was coming out, and it would have a preface by Stephen Levinson. And so somebody had thought to mention to either Stephen or to the editor that they could get back in touch with Penny Lee, who had actually written a book based quite heavily on LTR. And then I was involved from then on. And they had, by that time, they'd got a professional index done. So I suggested some modifications to, a professional indexer doesn't necessarily know which terms are going to have theoretical implications, even if they occur once. So I was anxious to get any special term in terms of my theory into the index, and I did that. Yeah, I edited, I checked the afterward, and I helped to create a new reading list, and I suggested they take out the original foreword. I thought it was only necessary to keep Carol's.
So the other foreword or preface was by Stuart Chase, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
And why did you think it shouldn't be taken out?
Why? Oh, well, Carol was strategic, very strategic, and someone, probably me, if I'd been younger, should have written an article on it. John Carroll probably didn't know that Worf despised Chase and thought basically that he was a fraud, you know.
I mean, so do you think that it's part of the spirit of the times, if I can put it like that, that there was a lot of interest in the possible connections between language and thought? I mean, so there's the Worfian linguistic anthropology angle, but even at the level of popular culture, there are things like Newspeak, you know, in Orwell's 1984, a language that's invented to control thought. And there's, you know, the work of people like Stuart Chase, you know, who wrote, I think it was The Tyranny of Words, which was similarly a sort of an account of how we need to reform language, or at least pay attention to language in order to ensure that we can think, you know, more freely, that our thought is not constrained by language. Like, there was the whole atmosphere of this talk about how language and thought might be connected.
Yes and no. I mean, you have to remember that there had been a series of conferences. So there was one which was moderated by Hoyer. That's 1953. But there was another one as well. There were about three of them. And then there were a bunch of collections in the early 60s. They were very pessimistic. And this is really before Chomsky came into his own. So Carol did some work with colleagues. Carol and Casagrande is a particular well-known example. And that's very much in the tradition that Lucy took up. It's very like the studies, those studies that were done in the 50s. And there were heaps and heaps of studies in the 70s. Well, of course, by the 70s, you do have that big interest in language and thought. But you have to remember, too, that it was fed by language, thought, and reality, by Worf's stuff. You hear of people of that vintage who carried around. And linguists were caught because Chomsky was coming up. Anthropological linguistics was still really, really important. There was that enormous sense of betrayal and disappointment that descriptive linguistics was being pushed aside, when any anthropological linguist knew that it was absolutely vital that it be maintained. But they tried to do linguistic relativity research along the lines of the psychology of the 50s and 60s. You had to have variables, you had controlled variables. But by trying to narrow down something as complex and amorphous as language, they had to find a very narrow context in which to test something very constrained. And Worf himself had done that with Hopi in a famous article about punctual and segmentative aspects of verbs in Hopi. That's a very important article, really, because as Hockett and Quown both wrote, they said, you know, they didn't think that Worf's greatest contribution was anything to do with what is usually argued about. It was his ability to observe subtle linguistic, and we know he was particularly interested in grammatical phenomena, and see the patterns in them, see what they were about. See, that's how he managed to develop something like his version of linguistic relativity.
So thank you very much for answering those questions. And the main lesson that I think I've taken from our discussion today is that I need to become a hippie so that I can join the ex-hippie school of intellectual history and really understand Worf.
I think John Leavitt would probably approve of that. Thank you very much.